Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star, then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Bella, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop, Understanding HER2-Low Breast Cancer. And today's program is supported by an educational grant from Daiichi Sankyo and made possible through an independent grant from Merck and Company, Inc., and I really want to thank them for their support of today's program. Now, we have over 135 participants on the call today, and you come from all over the United States, from both urban, rural, suburban, and frontier communities. And we also have a number of international participants from Germany, Iraq, the Philippines, Poland, Saudi Arabia, Uganda, and United Kingdom. So this is truly a global call, and it's a pleasure to have all of you on this program today. And now I'm going to introduce our first speaker, who is Dr. Paolo Tarantino. Dr. Tarantino is breast medical oncologist, clinical researcher, Breast Oncology Center, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, Harvard Medical School. And Dr. Tarantino will be addressing the overview of HER2-low breast cancer. What is the HER2 status of my cancer? What does this mean? Standard treatment options and how biomarker testing informs treatment decisions. It's my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Tarantino.
Thank you so much, Carolyn, for this kind introduction. And thank you, everyone, for connecting. And good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, depending on where you are. So I'm Paolo Tarantino, and I've been working on HER2 and HER2-low expression now for several years. And so let me just provide an overview of what HER2 is. This is basically a protein that is present in most breast cancer, almost virtually all breast cancers, in a different degree. And there is about 15 to 20% of all breast cancer cases that have a striking overexpression of this protein, which in the 90s of the past century was found associated with an increase in the aggressiveness of the tumor. These tumors were called HER2-positive tumors. And what was discovered is that if you blocked this protein with a drug called trastuzumab, these tumors would actually revert. This aggressiveness would become much less aggressive, and this would translate into significant clinical benefits for patients. And so now it's been almost 30 years that we've been using several drugs that block HER2, that target HER2, in these tumors that we call HER2-positive, and once again, that are found to have a high overexpression of this protein, of HER2, on the tumor cell. However, one major shift has occurred over approximately the last 5 years, because instead of just talking about HER2-positive tumors, let's say 20%, and HER2-negative, the other 80% of all breast tumors, we introduced this intermediate category called HER2-low. And HER2-low basically means that there is some HER2 present that can be detected with an assay called immunohistochemistry, and the score of HER2 with immunohistochemistry is 1+ or 2+ without an amplification, and this is not clearly associated with the aggressiveness of the tumor and with the prognosis, but it can be utilized for therapeutic purposes. And this is why suddenly it became important to report when a tumor is not HER2 positive, but still HER2 low. And then we also have those tumors that are not HER2, neither HER2 positive nor low, and we call them HER2 zero. And so in order to understand if a breast tumor is HER2 positive, HER2 low, or HER2 zero, what we do is usually look at the pathology report. And in most cases of pathology reports, the pathologist performs an immunohistochemical staining, often abbreviated as IHC. And so with this IHC assay, the pathologist is able to tell you how much HER2 staining is present on the tumor specimen. And if the staining is intense and diffuse, it calls it 3+, and that is positive. Or it can be 2+, and then the pathologist adds another layer of complexity. It does an amplification testing. And so if it's 2+ FISH positive, amplification positive, it's still called HER2 positive. Then you have those cases that are HER2 2+, but amplification negative. We call them HER2 low. And 1+, we don't even look for the amplification, we just call them low. And finally, we have HER2 zero, that we call HER2 zero. So the low, once again, HER2 low means IHC 2+, non-amplified, or 1+. And how often do we find this HER2 low expression? We find it in about 50% of all breast cancer cases. About half of all breast cancers are HER2 low. And the most important aspect is, why is HER2 low important? It doesn't seem to be associated with the prognosis, with the aggressiveness of the tumor, but we did find that there is a specific type of drugs that seem to work very well even in the presence of low HER2 expression. These drugs are called antibody drug conjugate, or in abbreviation, ADCs. And what they do is that they deliver chemotherapy selectively to the tumor cells that express a certain target, in this case, HER2. And so they do not use HER2 as a molecular switch. They do not block HER2 signaling. They do not alter the biology of the tumor, but they use HER2 as an anchor to deliver a chemotherapy precisely to the tumor cells. And right now we have several of these drugs approved, but one specific drug is approved for patients that have HER2 low metastatic breast cancer. And this drug is called trastuzumab deruxtecan, or an easier name is TDXD. It's 4 letters, TDXD. The commercial name is Enhertu, and this drug has been approved based on a trial called Destiny Breast 04 and a second trial called Destiny Breast 06. But what's important to remember is that this drug worked much better than traditional chemotherapy for about double the duration. For the progression-free survival, the way we measure the duration of benefit with this drug was doubled compared to conventional chemotherapy, and also the overall survival of the patients that received this drug was prolonged compared to traditional chemotherapy. And this is why now it's very important, whenever we have a patient that has a tumor that is not HER2 positive, to distinguish if that tumor is HER2 low or HER2 zero. And there's actually been some further changes recently that shown that even within HER2 zero, some patients may still have some HER2, some minimal HER2 that may allow TDXD to work. We call them HER2 ultra low. But this is just to say that this is in continuous evolution. We're learning how these ADCs work, and we're learning that potentially we're going to expand the benefit of these ADCs and TDXD to more patients with breast cancer. And so, in short, we now have one drug that is available for patients with HER2 low metastatic breast cancer, and this is why it's important to know when a tumor is HER2 low. And a tumor is HER2 low if at least one specimen, either a biopsy or a resection or some pathologic specimen, has a HER2 score of 1+ or 2+ non-amplified.
Wow. Thank you so much, Dr. Tarantino. That was just a superb presentation, just stellar in your presentation. And actually, you are the first speaker, so you really have set the stage for today's program. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A, so thank you so much. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Kamal Abu Hussein. And Dr. Hussein is Assistant Professor of Medicine, Cooper Medical School at Rowan University, Adjunct Assistant Professor, Department of Breast Medical Oncology, MD Anderson Cancer Center, Co-Director of the Janet Knowles Breast Cancer Program, Director of Breast Cancer Clinical Trials, MD Anderson Cancer Center at Cooper. And Dr. Hussein will be addressing new targeted treatments, updates on investigational new drugs in clinical trials, how research contributes to treatment options, what's new in the prevention and management of treatment side effects, symptoms, discomfort, pain, and quality of life concerns, and guidelines for payer telehealth, telemedicine appointments, including technology, prepared list of questions, and discussion of open notes. It's really my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Hussain.
Thank you so much, Dr. Mesner, for the kind introduction and for including me in the discussion of this important topic. As we know, understand that HER2-low tumors may have distinct therapeutic responses compared to the HER2-0 or the HER2-null tumors. And as we heard previously from Dr. Tarantino, DESTINY-Breast04 trial was the first trial that introduced a therapeutic option to the HER2-low breast cancer. And so in a way, even though that term really existed previously, but because the trial needed clinically meaningful, as now we have a drug that patients with HER2-low metastatic disease can benefit from. So in a way, it added this new term to the breast cancer vocabulary. So as we heard from him with this excellent introduction, the HER2-low breast cancer is characterized by low levels of HER2 protein expression, and that is distinguishing it from the HER2-positive and the HER2-negative subtypes. And about 55% of breast cancer cases fall into this category. And by the way, it's important to keep in mind that this category includes both hormone receptor positive and triple negative breast cancers. One major challenge is actually identifying this group of patients. And unfortunately, the conventional IHC or the immunohistochemistry technique, which is usually good for distinguishing the HER2-positive cases, often falls short in reliably identifying the HER2-low expression. So there has been a lot of ongoing work trying to develop better methods and quantitative assays utilizing this quantitative immunofluorescence, which hopefully would allow the measurement of the HER2 protein levels in a more precise way, particularly in the low expression range. Also, the integration of artificial intelligence or AI in pathology has shown promise in improving the HER2 testing accuracy, and I'm sure we'll hear a lot of the excellent details regarding pathology from our next speaker, Dr. Rendy. As we view the whole HER2 protein expression as a continuum or a spectrum, now it's very exciting to see the ongoing trials where they are testing effectiveness of HER2-targeted treatments in combination with immunotherapy for patients with advanced HER2-positive disease. Also in HER2, or trastuzumab deruxtecan, first showed benefit in the HER2-positive metastatic or advanced stage before it was shown to be effective in the HER2-low setting. And typically, whenever a drug is successful in the advanced or metastatic stage, it starts moving forward to earlier stages of disease. So drugs like Enhertu being tested in patients with earlier stage HER2-positive and HER2-low breast cancer, and those are the patients that have a disease that has not yet become resistant to therapy, and that makes it very likely that as we use those drugs in women whose cancers aren't so resistant, that we are going to see a much bigger benefit and hopefully prevent metastatic disease from developing in the first place. Now, this discussion won't be complete without mentioning the HER2 ultra-low breast cancer category, and this is an emerging classification within the HER2 negative spectrum that is characterized by even minimal HER2 protein expression on tumor cells. And again, it is important because now it has a potential responsiveness to novel treatment therapies. I would say that identifying this category could even be a bit more challenging from the pathologic standpoint, and typically we think of it as patients who have their IHC scores of 0, with more than 0% but less than 10% of the tumor cells showing this incomplete or faint weak membrane staining. And this became quite relevant recently because now It does have a therapeutic target after the results of the DESTINY-Breast06 clinical trial, which demonstrated that, again, Enhertu or T-DXd significantly improves progression-free survival, which refers to the length of time that a patient with metastatic disease would live without evidence of progression in their disease, compared to standard of care chemotherapy in patients with HER2-low and HER2-ultra-low breast cancer. Another clinical trial is ACE-Breast03, and that is a trial that is studying the use of a second-generation antibody-drug conjugate that is targeted against the HER2 protein, and that trial is testing its activity in patients with HER2-positive and HER2-low metastatic breast cancer after previously being treated with T-DXd or Enhertu. And this antibody-drug conjugate, which is called ARX788, is a next-generation anti-HER2 antibody-drug conjugate that is stably linked or conjugated to a chemotherapy payload that is a potent tubulin inhibitor. Another ADC, datopotamab deruxtecan, or Dato-DXd, also known as Datroway, is another ADC which was approved by the FDA earlier this year for patients with metastatic hormone receptor-positive HER2-negative breast cancer who have undergone prior endocrine-based therapy and chemotherapy. It was shown to be superior to standard of care chemotherapy in terms of progression-free survival, and it had fewer side effects compared to chemotherapy. Now, I was also asked to address some of the side effects, and regarding the side effects of Enhertu, I have to say that my experience with that drug has been quite favorable overall, and many patients find it easy to tolerate. However, a few things that could be problematic include nausea, fatigue, alopecia, which means areas of hair loss, diarrhea, and also interstitial lung disease. I'm going to focus on mainly two side effects, which are the nausea and the interstitial lung disease. And for nausea, we administer strong anti-nausea medicines before the treatment is infused, including drugs like steroids, Zofran, and Emend, and this could be associated with also a delay type of nausea, which can happen a day up to 3 days from the infusion time, and some medicines like a small dose of olanzapine, also known as Zyprexa, could be quite helpful in addressing this delayed nausea. Now, ILD, or interstitial lung disease, which means inflammation of the lung tissue, which is the most serious side effect associated with Enhertu. And it's very crucial to make sure that we identify it and treat it aggressively early on. Throughout the Enhertu trials, ILD occurred in about 10 to 15% of patients. And unfortunately, some fatal cases happened in about 2 to 3% of the cases. There are different types or different grades of ILD, ranging from grade 1 to grade 5, with grade 1 being without any symptoms, only evidence of abnormalities on the scan. And then the symptom severity goes up as we go from grade 2 all the way up to grade 5. And we always make sure that we start steroids early on, and we taper them down very slowly, and we monitor with scans, CT scans regularly during and after steroid therapy, and typically we involve a pulmonologist early on. So it is really important to note here that participation of our patients in clinical trials is the only way that we are able to find better modalities for treating diseases in general and hoping to prevent the development of late stage or metastatic disease. If we improve the current standard of care for treatment of some early-stage cancers with high-risk features. I would always encourage any patient to consider participation in clinical trials if it's available at the center where you're getting your treatment, as you'll almost always get something extra on top of the standard of care, and this is really the main goal of any clinical trial, basically trying to improve on how we're doing things currently. Now, regarding the concept of telemedicine, and I think we're all very familiar with what telemedicine is by now, as the majority of patients, if not all of them, have experienced what a telemedicine visit really is. Most of us started using it since the beginning of the pandemic, and it has been very helpful for us and our patients to continue to take care of them in a safe way. I do like a lot of aspects of telemedicine, and many patients report their satisfaction with how they are able to save time, normally wasted in all the logistics from the time they leave their home until they are seen in the office. And above all, also, it helps minimize exposure during critical times like the pandemic time. And I absolutely don't think it's a replacement to the in-person visits, but I think that they are appropriate when the purpose of the visit is to go over some lab work results, test results, address brief questions. So really a hybrid model of both telemedicine and in-person visits is a reasonable approach as they both complement each other nicely. You could also include someone like a family member or a friend who acts as a nice advocate, like what we do regularly for in-person office visits. Now, the last topic I was asked to cover was the concept of open notes, and basically that means giving patients full access and easy access to their medical notes, really all of it, whether it's clinical visit notes, progress notes, test results, imaging reports, pathology, and so forth. And the main goal of such practice is to give patients more transparency and control and allow them to better understand what they're going through and help them go over the information again if they forgot some of the information discussed during the actual visit. And overall, we're empowering patients and making them a true partner in their own care. However, it does come with challenges, including complex terms and medical jargon that could be difficult to understand, and also reading about a serious diagnosis or a test result without enough support and the possibility of misinterpretation of normal comments. So it's always important to prepare questions before your visits and discuss anything that is not clear with your physician to make sure that you're navigating this in a healthy and a productive way. At this point, I want to thank you for your attention, and I will pass it back to you, Dr. Messner. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Hussain. That was just an excellent, stellar presentation. Lots of information for our participants. I know there'll be lots of questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you so much. Just an excellent presentation. And our next speaker is Dr. Mara Rendy. And Dr. Rendy is a pathologist specializing in breast cancer. She's with Abbott Northwestern Hospital, Hospital Pathology Associates, and Alina Health, Minneapolis, Minnesota. And Dr. Rendy will be addressing the role of the pathologist and diagnostic testing, what is immunohistochemistry, IHC test, or fluorescence in situ hybridization FISH test. It is my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Rendy.
Hi, thank you so much. As Dr. Messner said, my name is Mara Rendy. I'm a breast pathologist, and I work with your breast surgeons, medical oncologists, and radiation oncologists to determine what treatment needs to happen. As you're learning about HER2-low breast cancer, it's the pathologist that determines the level of HER2 expression of your cancer. The way this is done is when a biopsy is taken, either of the primary breast tumor in your breast, or of an axillary lymph node, or of a metastatic site, the pathologist will make the diagnosis of cancer. Then we do several tests to determine things like the estrogen receptor, progesterone receptor, and HER2 status of the cancer, and that dictates your treatment. Today, we're only going to focus on HER2. So as we briefly talked about, HER2 is a growth factor receptor that when it is activated on a cell, causes that cell to grow and survive. Like all proteins, HER2 is coded by a gene that's made up of DNA in the nucleus. Then what happens is the cell will turn the DNA through a series of steps into a protein. And then in the case of HER2, the active protein is put out on the surface of the cell. In breast cancer, there are differing levels of expression of HER2, and the pathologist can determine the level of HER2 by looking either at the protein on the cell surface or at the DNA and how many copies of the gene are present in the nucleus. Now, while I could give a whole hour-long talk about the variants of HER2, we're really only going to talk about HER2 low today. So the main way we evaluate HER2 low breast cancers is by looking at the amount of protein that is present on the cell surface of the cancer cell. From that, we categorize the breast cancers. So here are the current categories for HER2 per the College of American Pathologists, and it's what you'll see reported if you're in the U.S. So right now there is one HER2 positive, and then there's HER2 negative. There's the two splits. But negative is currently split into two subcategories. You have the HER2 low category that we're going to focus on today, and you also have the HER2 negative null. So when we talk about HER2 low, the categories that sit in that group are HER2 equivocal 2 plus FISH negative, which I'll talk about briefly at the end of this, HER2 negative 1 plus, and HER2 negative 0 ultra low. Those are your HER2 low categories that are eligible for treatment with drugs like Enhertu. Then last, there's HER2 negative 0 null. Okay, and it gets confusing because we have HER2 negative 0 ultra low and HER2 negative 0 null, and I'll explain how we come up with those here in a second. So the way we do this is we look at the proteins on the cell surface. We're going to use a process called immunohistochemistry, or you'll hear people refer to it as IHC. This measures the amount of protein on the cell surface. It does this by using a specific antibody, which is really just a protein that specifically recognizes the HER2 protein and only the HER2 protein. But there's a trick. That HER2 antibody protein is tagged so that it shows up with a brown color. So as the pathologist, I can look through the microscope and I can see brown on the surface of the cell and determine how much brown there is to categorize it into one of those categories that we were just talking about. So if there's a lot of brown, it's very intense and circumferential, we call that HER2 positive. That is not the HER2 low cancers. There can also be a moderate amount of brown, a little bit of brown, barely any brown, and then no brown at all on the cancer cells. Now, there are specific percentages and guidelines that the pathologists use, but I don't want to go into those because it'll just muddy the waters. So the key things to remember here is if you have a lot of HER2 on your cells, that gets categorized as HER2 positive breast cancer, which is different from what we're talking about today. However, if there's a moderate amount of HER2 on the cells, you'll see it called equivocal 2 plus, and we need further testing by fluorescence in situ hybridization. I'm going to talk about that in a second, but the key point is that after FISH, that's the nickname for fluorescence in situ hybridization, the cancer will be designated as either HER2 positive or HER2 negative, 2 plus. So the only ones we're interested in for HER2 low purposes are HER2 negative, 2 plus of those. Then if we keep going, if there's only a little bit of HER2 brown staining on the cells, we call that negative 1 plus. Or if there's barely any, but I can still see it under the microscope, then we call it negative 0, but ultra low, because there is still some staining. So your HER2 low breast cancers include HER2 negative 2 plus, HER2 negative 1 plus, and HER2 negative 0 ultra low, those three. So those are the ones that are eligible to be treated with drugs like Enhertu. There can also be absolutely no HER2 brown staining at all, and that is HER2 negative 0 null. As of right now, those cancers are not considered HER2 low and are not eligible for the medications we've been discussing. So IHC, or immunohistochemistry, is the method that we are currently using to determine if a breast cancer is in the HER2-low category. So that's what your medical oncologists are really looking for, that test to determine if you're eligible for something like Enhertu. I quickly do want to cover what HER2 fluorescence in situ hybridization is, because that can play a role probably earlier on in your testing than where you are at this point. But FISH will show up, and what happens here is if we have a moderate amount of HER2 by IHC, what that's telling us is there's a moderate amount of HER2 proteins on the cell surface. What we will then do, because we aren't sure which category you go into, if it's positive or negative, we then look at the DNA and the genes within the cell to determine if there's an increase in the amount of HER2 genes present in the cell. This is called HER2 amplification. If there is HER2 amplification in the nucleus where the DNA is, then the cancer can be considered positive for HER2 amplification, and that group of cancers goes with the HER2 positive cancers. But if you're currently living with HER2 low breast cancers, you do not have this type of HER2 breast cancer, because by definition, HER2 low cancers are negative for HER2 amplification. So we don't use FISH or fluorescent in situ hybridization to do the test to determine if you're eligible for the treatments for HER2 low breast cancer. So the bottom line is, if you have metastatic carcinoma or certain types of recurrent breast cancer, the pathologist will evaluate your tumor using IHC for HER2, and if your HER2 results are negative 2+, 1+, or 0 ultra low, you can be given the new class of drugs. If your cancer is negative 0 null, right now you're not eligible for those drugs, but more work is being done. That's all I have.
Thank you so much, Dr. Rendy. That was just a superb presentation, stellar. And I think a lot of people don't have a chance to hear from a pathologist, so it's really so helpful. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. So thank you so much. And our next speaker is Kara Rogan. And Ms. Rogan is a licensed certified genetic counselor. She's with the Department of Clinical Genomics at the Mayo Clinic, and she'll be addressing the role of the genetic counselor and understanding your genetic family history and non-heritable somatic changes. It's my great pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Rogan.
Thank you for that introduction, and thank you for having me today. So the role of a genetic counselor is to help facilitate and guide patients diagnosed with breast cancer through the process of germline genetic testing. What we mean by germline is that it is a test that's performed on a blood or saliva sample that looks for disruptive changes or mutations in the genes that you were born with. Approximately 5 to 10% of women and 20% of men diagnosed with breast cancer are found to have an underlying genetic cause for their breast cancer. And that likelihood of finding a genetic cause might be higher in people who have a personal or family history of breast, ovarian, prostate, or pancreatic cancer. For an individual that has a hereditary breast cancer gene mutation, their lifetime risk of developing breast cancer is higher than the average woman's risk of about 12% and the average man's risk, which is less than 1%. At some institutions, genetic testing is offered to everyone with breast cancer, while some institutions may have slightly stricter guidelines regarding who is offered that testing. The first genes identified that are linked to hereditary breast cancer were the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes, sometimes referred to as BRCA. Prior to 2013, these were the only genes available for clinical testing, but we now test for more genes linked to hereditary risk for breast cancer, such as ATM, CHEK2, PALB2, and others. So some individuals who previously had negative genetic testing for BRCA1 and BRCA2 only are eligible for updated multi-gene panel testing. In addition, since about 2018, the option of paired DNA and RNA testing on a blood sample has been available. This addition of RNA analysis increases the likelihood of finding a gene mutation in less than 1% of individuals tested. At a genetic counseling appointment, the genetic counselor reviews what will be tested, the possible results received from the testing, and what the results could mean for the patient and their family. They also discuss insurance coverage of testing and laws about genetic discrimination. Once the results of genetic testing are available, the genetic counselor reviews and interprets the genetic test results for the patient. One benefit of genetic testing is for the treatment of HER2-low breast cancer. Individuals with a mutation in one of the BRCA genes and possibly in the PALB2 gene may benefit from a treatment called a PARP inhibitor, depending on some other features of their breast cancer as well. Another benefit of genetic testing is identifying other cancer risks in the patient and their relatives. If a gene mutation is identified, this may tell the patient that they have an increased risk of developing other cancers. And at that point, we would initiate some high-risk screening or preventive measures to help prevent cancer or detect it at an early stage. When a gene mutation is identified in someone with breast cancer, genetic testing is recommended for their relatives. Their first-degree relatives like parents, siblings, and children have a 50% chance of having that same gene mutation. And for those relatives who are found to have the same gene mutation, screening and preventive measures can then be implemented. In women with a hereditary breast cancer syndrome, breast cancer screening typically starts at younger ages and includes an annual breast MRI. And for certain genes that have very high risks of developing breast cancer, a risk-reducing mastectomy or removal of the breast tissue can be considered to reduce the lifetime risk for breast cancer. Men with a hereditary breast cancer syndrome may start clinical breast exams in their 30s and may consider a mammogram starting in their 50s. Lastly, I just wanted to say that genetics is a rapidly changing field. We are making new discoveries every day about the hereditary causes of cancer and how to improve our genetic tests. We'll also continue to gain insight into the exact cancer risks associated with each gene, as there is some uncertainty at this time. Genetic counselors really attempt to remain at the forefront of these changes to educate patients and providers about advances in the field. They're also available to help families cope with a diagnosis of hereditary cancer and empower them to be proactive regarding their cancer risks. Genetic counselors also partner closely with the rest of the care team to communicate results and current medical management guidelines, and we also help connect patients and their families with available resources and research studies. Thank you again for having me today.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Duggan. That was just a superb presentation, stellar and very informative. And I think that certainly having a genetic counselor when you have a breast cancer is very important. Meeting with one can be very, very helpful for you in coping with breast cancer. Thank you so much, or with any type of cancer. Thank you. And our next speaker is Ms. Diana Bearden, and Ms. Bearden is an oncology dietitian at the Michael E. DeBakey VA Medical Center, and she'll be addressing the role of the oncology dietitian and the nutrition and hydration concerns and tips. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Bearden.
Thank you so much, Carolyn. I'm excited to be part of today's presentation. Nutrition and hydration are fundamental in providing your body what it needs to function. A question I get a lot with patients is, you know, what should I eat and what should I avoid while I'm getting my cancer treatment? The answer to that question is going to be individualized based on your treatment plan, any comorbidities that you have, your level of nourishment, just to name a few. However, in general, a whole foods plant-based diet is what we want to aim for. And that looks like where about two-thirds of your plate is covered with a plant-based food, such as a fruit, vegetable, grain, bean, pea, lentil, nut, seeds. And the other third is covered with a lean protein, such as a wild-caught fish, a white-breasted fowl, such as chicken or turkey, lean red meats. You can also occasionally supplement or substitute rather, the protein is from an animal base to a plant base, such as a bean, pea, or lentil. The plant-based foods provide your body with some unique components, such as antioxidants, phytochemicals. Lean protein provides your body with the building blocks to help repair your body from injuries such as surgery and other treatments. The key to a whole foods plant-based diet is you want the food to look like it was when it was harvested. So if you're eating something, for example, that has apple in it, you just really eat the apple. The apple's the way to go. And that's something that a lot of folks get confused about because there's so much now in the grocery store, it's really hard to know what the best product is and what these product labels mean. But a dietitian is there to help support you and guide you with these questions. A dietitian is part of your healthcare team. They can help individualize your nutrition plan. As you go through treatment, your plan may change. So connecting with your healthcare team is so important, such as reporting any changes in your tolerance to diet or any new side effects that you may be experiencing. Oftentimes, there are side effects with treatment, and each person's experience is different, so your communication is vital to us helping you as soon as possible. One thing we oftentimes forget about because we're talking so much about eating is about hydration, and hydration is so important. Dehydration can bring its own set of side effects and concerns and issues. So staying hydrated is a fundamental component of your well-being. 8 to 10 8-ounce glasses of fluid a day is a general guideline. However, some treatments may result in increasing that or decreasing that. So again, talking with your healthcare team about your unique needs is so important. Remember there's so many members of your healthcare team. Knowing how to reach out to them and getting to them as soon as possible is the best way for us to help you as soon as we can. I'm going to close with that and hand the line back over to Carolyn.
So much, Ms. Bearden. That was just an excellent presentation and lots of informative information from our participants on the importance of foods that we eat and hydration. Thank you. And our next speaker is Ms. Cassie Spector, and she's an oncology social worker, and she's a breast and gynecological cancers program coordinator at Cancer Care, and she'll be discussing briefly Cancer Care's free programs and services and giving information about Cancer Care's Hope Line and our website as well. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Spector.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization providing free professional support services and information to help people manage the emotional, practical, and financial challenges of cancer. Our comprehensive services include resource navigation, counseling, support groups, educational workshops, publications, and limited financial assistance. Individuals diagnosed with breast cancer may choose to supplement their existing social networks by joining a support group or engaging in counseling. There are many aspects of a breast cancer diagnosis that may be addressed through psychosocial supportive services. Some of these areas include making informed treatment decisions, quality of life concerns, clinical trials, fertility options, and communication with one's medical team. Many hospitals, treatment centers, and nonprofit organizations offer supportive services as well. Being a member of a support group can be helpful in having the opportunity to speak with others who are going through similar experiences, obtain information, and provide support. Currently, Cancer Care offers several breast cancer support groups online. Our online support groups aim to reduce feelings of loneliness and anxiety, explore new ways of coping, and increase feelings of empowerment, provide practical information about treatment and resources. Our online support groups take place using a password-protected message board format and are led by oncology social workers. You can register for an online support group through Cancer Care's website, cancercare.org, by selecting Our Services, then Support Groups. Individuals may also experience practical and financial concerns throughout one's treatment, and please know if you're encountering such financial hardships, there are organizations that may be able to help you. Cancer Care offers resource navigation services that are short-term and strength-based for both patients and for caregivers affected by cancer nationally. A trained specialist will work with the client in connecting them to resources, referrals, and financial assistance. If you're interested in learning more about the support services Cancer Care offers, I encourage you to call Cancer Care's National Hope Line at 800-813-813 4673 to speak with one of our oncology social workers. At Cancer Care, our oncology social workers are trained in how breast cancer diagnosis can impact an individual as well as their loved ones. It's been such a pleasure to be part of this program. Thank you so much for your attention. I'll turn it back to Dr. Messner.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Spector. That was just an excellent presentation, Stella, and lots of resources for people. Thank you. And now we're going to move on to the Q&A, and I'm going to ask Bella to explain to you how to queue up for questions.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
And the first question is for Dr. Tarantino. Is it common for BRCA1 genetic cancer to be HER2 low?
Yes. So the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genetic mutations, as we heard previously from our genetic counselor, is detected by genetic testing. Now, the HER2 low is an independent test that is done by the IHC and by the in situ hybridization. So they are two separate things. And I think we do testing for every breast cancer patient regardless of their BRCA gene mutation. I don't know exact numbers, but they are two separate things.
And another question.
This is Dr. Rendy.
Yes.
I can add to that if you'd like. Yes, they are two separate tests, as Dr. Hussain just said, but it is somewhat common for BRCA patients oftentimes have HER2 negative overall cancers, and oftentimes those are HER2 low. So it is not unusual to see a BRCA patient with HER2 low breast cancer.
And another question for Dr. Hussain, are all newly diagnosed patients' pathology slides now evaluated for HER2 low?
So any newly diagnosed breast cancer patient gets testing for their ER, PR, and the HER2 status. And the HER2 status typically is started with IHC testing, where they report a number. So if it is HER2 positive, we're going to have that information readily available. And if they're not positive, then they will be either a HER2 0, HER2 1 plus, or 2 plus, which is sort of borderline, and they will reflect to FISH testing, as Dr. Rendy explained, and that is going to help us identify who are the patients that are HER2 low. This helps us only currently in the metastatic setting because we have an indication for a drug, the Enhertu, that we alluded to earlier, but for the early stage setting, it doesn't really play any role in choosing any therapeutic option. So the answer is yes.
And another question. Is Enhertu administered by IV only?
Correct. It's an IV infusion that is given every 3 weeks.
Okay. So this question is HER2 low. This is Dr. Hussain. Is HER2 low its own cancer type, or is it used to describe someone's breast cancer?
So it's really not a different cancer type. As Dr. Tarantino explained earlier, it's all a continuum or a spectrum. Different levels of expression of the protein that is very heavily expressed on the surface of breast cells in general. But there are cancers that are very amplified, and those are the HER2 positive. There are cancers that have very low to zero expression. And all the middle area, all the middle range is a HER2 low or HER2 ultra low, which means a fainter or less pronounced expression of the HER2. So it's a variation of a big spectrum.
And a question for you, Dr. Hussain. Is ILC respond different to ADCs than IDC?
Yes. The invasive ductal carcinoma, which is IDC, is the most prevalent subtype pathologically of breast cancer. And most of the data that we have regarding to response to therapeutics and behavior and biology is being drawn from clinical trials that mainly tested patients with IDC or invasive ductal carcinoma. Right now, I think we are learning more and more about ILC, the invasive lobular carcinoma, that has different patterns of growth, different look on imaging studies, and different ways of spreading in the body, and also different response to therapeutics, including chemotherapy, hormonal therapy, and many others. So there are some subtle differences in their behavior overall.
Excellent, thank you. Someone asked about if they missed part of the presentation. This will be available as a podcast within about a week of the program, and you'll be able to see this both, you'll be able to hear the podcast, and you'll also be able to read the closed caption for it as well. And now I'm just going to ask our speakers if they could just provide takeaways for our audience from today's program. I'll start with Dr. Hussain, Dr. Rendy, Ms. Rogan, and Ms. Spector. So we'll start with Dr. Hussain, just a takeaway, when people to take away from today's program.
I think what I would tell everybody is that we are at a time where there is genuine and growing hope for breast cancer patients, especially to the major scientific advances in treatment and diagnostic modalities, especially in a topic like HER2-low breast cancer. And those targeted molecules, ADCs or antibody-drug conjugates, have so much potential to drive this field forward. So it's always a nice reminder for everyone who's on the call that it is only possible through your participation in clinical trials that we will continue to see those advances.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Hussain. And Dr. Rendy?
The main takeaway I would have is that your pathologist, although you oftentimes don't meet with them, sometimes you can if you have questions, but they play a critical role in determining what actual treatments you will get, and you should make sure that they are involved in your care and talk to, if there's something in your pathology report you don't understand, to either ask to speak to the pathologist or make sure that your surgeon or medical oncologist goes through it with you, because all those details seem somewhat overwhelming, but they are the details that guide your treatment.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Rendy. And Ms. Rogan.
Yeah, I would say my main takeaway is that genetic testing can be beneficial for both the patient diagnosed with breast cancer as well as their family members. Treatment purposes, and also for identifying future cancer risks, and people who have had previous testing quite a few years back may want to consider doing some updated testing.
Excellent, thank you. And thank you so much. And Ms. Spector?
Yeah, so I would say my takeaway is really just to know that you're not alone, knowing that there's support available, whether you're looking for practical support, financial support, or support services, knowing that there's organizations available like Cancer Care, as well as your treatment team to refer back to see what resources are in your local community as well as offered at your treatment center.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And I want to thank all of our speakers. You've been phenomenal. And I also want to thank all of our participants. And this is a program we have not done before. We will probably do this program again in the future. It's an important type of breast cancer to be addressing, and so we will be doing this again. However, I realize we're not able to take all of your questions just because there were so many of you on the call today. However, I do want to comment on that. For those of you who had a chance to ask a question, who queued up for a question, please also take what you've learned from today's program, because you've obviously learned a lot. Take that to your treating healthcare team and ask them the question again, because remember, they have your medical records in front of them. They know a great deal about you, and they can answer your question again. And you also, because you know more, will have more information when you ask the question, and you'll probably be able to take in more from the person who answers your question. Also, for those of you who are in queue who didn't get to ask a question, please take your question to your treating healthcare team. They will be able to, of course, address your question. You've learned a lot, so you'll be able to take in more, and you'll be able to feel as if your question has been answered. Also, I just want to remind everybody that it seems that during the day, most of you are able to reach your physician or your healthcare team, but it seems like evenings, weekends, and holidays are quite challenging. So please always ask your physician how to reach them evenings, weekends, and holidays. Also, please notice that you are not alone, that you are now part of a community of support. Cancer Care is here to help you, and we will provide many other resources for you as well. You will be getting a SurveyMonkey evaluation. In that evaluation, there will be information about how to access clinical trials, how to get support, so lots of other information, both telephone numbers as well as references that you can access on the website that would be helpful to you. Again, I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.